Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. We're bringing you some of our favorite book conversations for 2016, and they're books that made a lot of best of lists. On such a cold day, let's take a trip to Jamaica with Nicole Dennis Benn. Her novel, Here Comes the Sun, is a lithe, artfully plotted debut, according to the New York Times. And we talked with her back in the summer. Jammin', and I hope you like jammin'
too. And the rules ain't no vow. We can do it. Okay, when we played that music, I'll bet you heard it and it conjured up images of a Jamaica the tourism board would have no quarrel with. Dappled water and wide beaches and maybe some discreet island ganja. The tourism board likely does have a quarrel with the portrait that writer Nicole Dennis Benn is painting of the island. It's a Jamaica of exclusion, economically, socially, culturally. Nicole told a reporter recently, "What I realize as a writer is the love-hate relationship that I have with the country." Nicole Dennis Benn's novel is titled Here Comes the Sun, and she's with us today from New York City. Nicole, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You've said that you had to come to terms with the idea that you are not obligated to be the public relations ambassador for Jamaica, but it sounds like it took you a while to settle in with the idea of that.
Yes, it actually did. Honestly, when I was writing Here Comes the Sun, I wasn't really thinking about, that concept of selling the country or, any risk. But afterwards, when I, interview after interview, when I was asked, I encountered another Jamaican novelist and, he basically just told me, listen, you do not work for the Jamaica Tourist Board. It will be fine.
That's Marlon James, isn't it?
Marlon James, exactly.
We love him on the show. He lives here much of the year.
Yes. So after hearing that, it was, very soothing to hear, because I really wanted to tell the truth, right? And even in my book, I highlighted the beauty as well as the ugliness. And I really wanted individuals to read that and, see the other side of paradise without thinking I'm placing judgment on the country itself, but knowing that I love the country. And it's in revealing these dark secrets or this ugliness that I hope to preserve the beauty and our culture.
Nicole, I think your experience is with kind of this telling the story of a place that you feel you love it, but you feel ambivalent about is not all that different from perhaps Latino writers, Native American writers who feel this pressure to be the spokesperson of all things, right, about their culture.
Right.
And the pressure from people who say you're giving us a bad name if you're going to tell that truth.
Right. Exactly. My wife and I had a conversation earlier, in the week. And, we're basically talking about the fact that, yes, there's still, even if I'm not the ambassador for the country, inevitably it's going to happen where, we're going to be asked questions, about it. Yes, I could answer to the best of my ability, but knowing that, anything that I say is definitely from love.
Okay, I hear that. And yet, I'm sure, aren't members of your family not too happy about some of the things you told in this novel about Jamaica?
Well, that's the thing. Initially, my mother, who was reading the novel, at first she gasped, right? She's like, oh my goodness. But then she, I gave her time. She finished the entire novel and she loved it. At first there was initial fear because, we come from this culture of shame as well. Don't air your dirty laundry in public. But then when she began to enjoy the story and saw what I really was doing, in terms of like tapping into the identity, the sexuality, that comes out of displacement and also humanizing working class Jamaican women. When she saw that, she's like, wow, I'm proud of you. So, that meant a lot more to me.
I'm glad to hear that. What did your mother say about what you're writing about when it comes to skin color and class mobility? I have to say that's one of the maybe not revelations, but ideas I hadn't thought through very clearly.
Right.
About the fact that this happens in communities of islands of color, communities of color.
Yes, you know, classism is definitely strong on the island, and also race as well, you know, racism. You know, we have a motto, out of many one people. And, you know, we learned that from basic school growing up. And, you know, as I got older and I began to really analyze this whole concept of out of many one people, knowing that there's a huge population of disenfranchised, poor, black, working class Jamaican, you know, we are not in that mix. And so, you know, that motto was more like a Band-Aid to silence any discussions of class disparities, race disparities, and socioeconomic disparities. You know, and also, too, you know, you asked about my mother again as a reader. You know, she saw that, and we know it because that we lived it. You know, we are working class people. And I mean, right now, of course, I'm living in America. I'm doing well. You know, I'm able to, like, you know, help my family. But back then, we grew up working class. And so we have seen that divide. And, you know, now I'm living in America and also going back frequently, I feel more empowered to talk about this in my work.
I think we should explain how this works, though. I mean, what you're saying here pretty explicitly is that the lighter the skin color, the more opportunity for social and class advancement you have. And I thought I would just read, there's a character named Miss Ruby in the story, and she's selling skin lightening treatments to girls, and her business is very good. And you write, because of her, women and girls who were nothing before have become something. Their newly lightened faces rendering them less invisible and more beautiful, worthy of jobs as front desk clerks, bank tellers, models, head sales associates, and in some cases, flight attendants. I mean, that's a real classism based on complexion that I never considered.
Yes, it was very real. You know, growing up in Jamaica, that was really real. And I mean, we're in 2016 now, and it still goes on. You know, because if you look at our Miss Jamaica World and Miss Jamaica Universe, the girls who are selected to represent our country beauty wise and also intellectually are those girls, the upper class girls who are lighter skin, you know, and with the quote unquote good hair. For example, because, you know, Jamaica, we do very well abroad. You know, right now in the Olympics, our runners are running. But if you look at the hue of our runners compared to the hue of the beauty queens, they're highly different. Right. And so as a working class dark skinned girl growing up, seeing that, you know, you're made to feel less than, you know, like, oh, wow, you can't represent your country because you look a certain way. Right. So I tapped into that because now a lot of our working class young boys and girls of the darker hue are bleaching their skin like Tandy.
Oh,
you know, they're applying these creams, these concoctions to appear lighter so that they can gain access. You know, and the unfortunate thing is that people look at them as, oh, well, this is vanity. This is just stupid. But it's deeper than that. You know, they're tapping into a history that we refuse to deal with as Jamaicans. Right. And nobody's really talking about that as much.
And that historical element of this is what? The colonization of it lasting hundreds of years later. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Can I ask you how the color of your skin compares, I guess, to what other people your age in school and in your community in Jamaica? I mean, how would you have been perceived?
Right. So I, you know, I'm dark skinned and, you know, in all honesty, you know, I went to a primary school. First of all, let me take you back. So I went to a primary school and at the primary school, that was my first encounter with the different treatment that you get as a darker skinned child.
Okay.
You know, we were beaten more, you know, or lighter skinned peers were not beaten because what happened is that the scars would be more more obvious. Right. And of course, parents could be called in. And then, of course, it relates to the access that those parents have. So, you know, I remember going to the primary school where, you know, some upper class people who want to save money would send their kids there. And the teacher would never touch those kids. Right. Because they're afraid that they'll lose their jobs or if they, you know, if that happens. But the darker skinned kids, they'll get beaten. You know, we get 80% on a test and it's easy to beat us because there's going to be no scarring, one. Or very minimal. And two, our parents are working class parents who don't really have the time to come in and check up on us and, you know, challenge the teachers, right? So that was my first exposure to that. And then in high school, you know, that was when I was more exposed to the class division. So, of course, I was going to this elite high school for girls. And most of those girls were, you know, the daughters of doctors, lawyers, like very professional elites. And that was when I really began to see, wow, you know, it's a totally different world. And again, the separation with skin color, you know, the lighter skinned girls separated themselves and eat lunch together. While the darker skinned girls, you know, we were like vying for these products, like how can we get lighter or how can we be accepted? You know, so it was a really weird thing to experience as a teenager, because, of course, you already are insecure as a teenager. So to add that to it, you know, it actually took years to work through that.
It sounds like it. So just from a curiosity standpoint here, these creams, the kind of cream that Miss Ruby is putting on Tandy and the kind of creams that it sounds like you used, are they permanent lighteners or are they chemicals that just bleach your skin and then in a couple of weeks your skin goes back to its regular color?
Yes, yeah, some are permanent, some are temporary. Wow. You know, I was lucky in that, you know, the one that I was exposed to was Naninola, right? It was a sort of a small fading cream. Okay. But then there are people who take it to another level, like Tandy, for example. And the people who I'm talking about now that are using these concoctions and they're mixing them up and they don't know the ingredients to these things. So these things actually end up destroying their skin, right? To the point where, you know, even if they do want to stop and they stop, their skin is already destroyed. Wow. And that's a huge, I have a background in public health as well. And that to me also is a public health crisis, because what's happening is that you're having all these people walking around with skin diseases,
right,
because of these creams.
Is it something that is openly discussed among public health professionals, among your political leaders in Jamaica? Or is it often, you know, there's pretense that it doesn't go on and the reasons why it happens?
Right. At first, there was denial. And then little by little, I've been seeing the discussions coming up. So there's a brilliant journalist on our island, Dionne Jackson Miller. And she taps into that. I mean, she had a very great documentary about this. And I thought that it would have inspired other people to start talking, especially with our Ministry of Health. But it just fell flat. Right. Nobody continued the discourse after that, because, you know, some people might walked away with the fact that, well, these kids are just, oh, you know, poor them. You know, people are not going to hire them. People are not going to want to associate with them. But in terms of tapping into the outcome, right, the health outcomes, I really would have wanted somebody to take that documentary and implement something. I don't know what we could have implemented, maybe a billboard ad that tells dark-skinned boys and girls that you're beautiful,
yeah.
You know, or, you know, it's so much, because it's also the infrastructure, you know, it's like David and Goliath, right? Because, you know, you could hand David a big rock, right? But you can't, like, help him to lift it. I don't know. It was, to me, for example, working class are already disenfranchised, you know, unlike here in America, for example, where education is free, their education is not free. Right. So here you're also fighting against a system, you know, where they're still going to feel unworthy. They're still going to look around them and see no opportunity. And so the next best thing that they reach for are these creams. Right. Feeling that that's one way they can get through some way or, right. somehow.
Nicole Dennis Benn is with us and we're talking about the experiences she had growing up in Jamaica and her observations about race and class and social mobility and equity and economics in Jamaica that are at the center of this terrific novel that she's written. You can read all about it at The Thread. You know, there's another subtext that I don't want to miss in that paragraph that I read where we've talked about the skin lightening. But you also say that, you know, these women and girls do this skin lightening because their newly lightened faces rendering them less invisible and more beautiful, worthy right. of jobs as front desk clerks, bank tellers, models, head sales associates. I mean, you know that in the United States, those are often viewed as entry-level jobs, not something that you necessarily only aspire to. You're saying something else about the economics of Jamaica, aren't you?
Yes. you know, again, you know, with the whole distinction of class and, you know, socioeconomic disparities, you know, a lot of people who don't have the opportunities to, for example, pass their Common Entrance or GSAT, this is that these are exams that could actually place you in these high schools that funnel you into college eventually or hopefully, while individuals who do not pass their exams, and you're talking about kids who are 11, 10 years old who are taking these exams.
Wow.
Let's say you do not pass this exam at 10 years old, you're funneled into a vocational school.
Wow.
Right? And that's your destiny for a long time. Unless if somehow you were able to break out or probably migrate and go somewhere else and aspire to be something else. But your destiny is determined for you for the most part. And, you know, on our island, usually it's actually the wealthy or, you know, expats who come back. They're the ones who have all these like ownership, you know, or job or careers, for example. But working class folks who do not have certain opportunities, these are the jobs that they get. And there's that level of complacency for the most part, you know, the front desk clerk or the security guard, you know, that's something that they inevitably end up doing. And they have to, given that there's nothing else, if they don't go back to school and get certain qualifications to do that.
So,
but yeah, but for the most part, there's not. Those are the jobs.
So at 10 or 11 years old, you took one of these exams and it showed that you had a lot of academic promise. Is that right?
Yes.
And so what happened within your family? Because, I mean, I think you've kind of written this out in this family that with Margot and Tandy, she's the youngest sister. Margot's the oldest sister. She works at the hotel. And then their mother, who's really kind of scraping and scrapping to keep the household together.
Right.
Tandy is this golden child who's going to achieve things because, right, she looks like she's got academic promise. This was you?
Yes. So I was that girl who, yes, I passed my Common Entrance. I got into this great high school. You know, it's considered as one of the top schools on the island. And so, of course, so much changed after that. You know, I'd be walking with my uniform in my own community and people would actually notice like, wow, she's an Andrews girl. You know, all of a sudden, you know, your stature change, right? It's like your neck is held high, right? And so it's just like a night like Jekyll and Hyde. You know, here I am from this community, from a working class community, a group in Vineyard Town. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm transported into this new world. And everything about me changed. And my parents noticed that as well. They were like, wow, you know, you're going to be the promise, right? You're the person who's going to carry our family. And they've always said that to me. You know, there was no doubt in their minds. And sure enough, you know, being at Andrews, I was exposed to the possibility of attending college in the United States, right? Because I wanted to be a doctor, or thought I did. And then, of course, it's similar to Tandy, actually, right? Because, you know, as a first generation college student, you know, I wanted to make the best out of it, right? I wanted to carry the family far. So there
right.
was definitely immense pressure there, like what Tandy felt, for sure.
I mean, to have your parents, I really can't imagine this, to have your parents say at such a young age, you are going to be the promise of this family. I mean, the pride that you would feel, but the oppressive responsibility of that.
Right. Exactly. You know, one of the things that, another thing too, you know, being an out lesbian was also something too that incited a lot of guilt. Right. Because here I was, you know, yes, the promise. But then I was harboring this dark secret that would inevitably separate me from them. So it was just a very interesting time to be going through that where, you know, you had to be the one moving forward. But then you knew something about your identity would be something that moved you two steps backward.
There's a lot of shame attached to that, I'm sure. Will you tell me how old you were when you knew that eventually you were going to have to tell your parents that you were gay?
I was actually 19, the first time I thought about coming out to them.
Yeah, but Nicole, how old were you when you knew that?
Oh, when I knew that I was gay. Oh, that was like, for me, very young.
Okay.
You know, from before I even took the Common Entrance, actually, and got into this this high school, you know, so it was really young. I knew then, but I knew that something was not right with it because, of course, there was no word for it I did not know anyone else in the culture who felt that way. You know, I was never exposed to that. And then one day when I was in high school, there was an interview done on TV. And I saw that they were interviewing some woman who defined herself as a lesbian. And I remember her face had to be hidden. You know, it was only her voice, but her voice had to be altered, you know, because of the stigma associated or attached with being a lesbian or a gay person on the island. And that was when I first knew, oh, my goodness, like, this is ridiculous. You know, and I knew then that I had to do something about that. I did not know what yet, but I knew I did not want to be interviewing somebody to be interviewing me, you know, 10 years from then. And I had to be behind a black screen to hide my identity.
So when you would play out the scenarios of what it was going to be like to tell your parents, I'm still the promise of this family, but this is also me, too. I like women. What were the scenarios that, you know, that you'd play out in your imagination about how your parents were going to react to that?
I honestly didn't even have much scenarios. You know, I know my father, for example, he was, you know, I call him this quintessential Jamaican man. You know, he's very opinionated for sure. And I've heard him talk to his friends a lot about, you know, gayness and, you know, about his kids. If any of his kids turned out to be gay, you know, he'd kill them, then kill himself. Like, I've overheard that in the past. And then, so he was the one I feared the most. But surprisingly, when I came out to him, he was actually the one who accepted me first.
Wow.
Perhaps being his daughter and being a woman, you know, that actually saved me. You know, because I thought that, you know, he would have gone off. But it turned out that he, you know, was understanding. It took him, I mean, there are things that he did not understand, but it's not like he did not pick the phone up and call, or he actually showed up to my wedding. He walked me down the aisle, you know, so it was really great. And then my mother, who's a more religious part, component of my parents, it took her a while. I mean, now she's great, but, you know, for her, it was mostly baby steps.
Nicole Dennis-Benn is with us. Much more to talk about in this theme that we're developing here in the conversation. The novel is called Here Comes the Sun. You hear us talking about her observations of the country that she comes from, Jamaica, and her experiences growing up and what that meant to be the person that so much of the aspirations of her family resided in, and then knowing that she had to carry this secret. Do you suffer equal amounts of discrimination in Jamaica over skin color, over sexuality? And I know that's a painful thing to contemplate, but I'm interested in it.
Right. I would say in day-to-day life in Jamaica, I would say the thing that you probably will get the most discrimination for is sexuality.
Okay.
Because with Jamaica, I feel like there's a performance of Jamaicanness. And so if you actually step outside of that box or do or say something that's so not quote unquote Jamaican, you're shunned, right? So of course, you know, on the island itself, you know, heterosexual relationship, that's the norm. For example, you know, a woman should know her place, a man know his place. You know, all those dynamics are still there.
Hmm.
Right. So even, you know, going back home, I had this interview and I mentioned, you know, being a feminist, for example. And that word, you know, this was in the Jamaica Gleaner, and somebody, you know, in the Jamaica Gleaner usually have all these reviews that you could see, like these comments. And they're always like horrible comments, no matter who the author is or who the person is writing it. And I remember how they took that word and said, oh my gosh, like, what is she now coming back to talking about? She's some feminist. Like, what is that? And how, you know, and the way how that, the reaction, you know, that visceral reaction to that, because first of all, we are a nation, you know, women are the forefront in our country, right? You know, we are at the front desk, we're doing everything, but it's a male energy. And if that's threatened in any way at all, that's definitely that warrants ostracism.
I don't know that it's all that different here, Nicole, right, as you might have. Okay, so feminism is worse in the eyes of some Jamaicans than being dark skinned or gay.
Yes,
feminism's even worse than that, huh? I mean, aren't there must be women. There's probably women in your family. Well, what? I was reading your acknowledgments, and I think you were talking about, was it your grandmother, your great-grandmother in Jamaica? She sounds like a feminist. Yeah.
Yes, Addie was. Addie was a feminist. And I feel like she gave me permission, you know, to speak my mind, to speak my truth. You know, because again, I tell you that we come from a culture of shame. And especially if you're a woman, you know, you're definitely meant to feel like you're less than or that you have no voice. You know, in the story itself, I even tap into the sexualization of our young girls.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how our bodies seem deemed as unworthy. You know, so for a woman like that to say, you know, in fact, she taught me how to write. And she, for some reason, you know, Ali would always say to me, you know, you have a story, you tell it. She was the first one who have ever said that to me. Mm. And for her to say that, I'm talking about 1980s. And, you know, she was elderly. And I'm like, what was it about this woman that would make her say that, right? What was her mentality at the time as a Jamaican woman who has never traveled? She never went to school beyond basic school. So something must have happened. And so, you know, even revisiting who the woman she was, you know, to me, that intrigued me a lot for her to tell this little 3-year-old girl that someday she's going to be somebody, you know, who can tell her truths or tell her story or live the life she wants to live.
And she is. Right. You Definitely. Fulfilled all those expectations of your great grandmother. I don't want to miss something that you just said, which is the sexualization of young girls in Jamaica. Obviously, that happens here and in many countries, but you've seen it in Jamaica. There are scenes in the novel where these teenagers, I mean, 15, 16, 17 years old, are going into resorts of Jamaica that are being frequented by American and European men. And they're not even what I'd think of as escorts, but they're not willing prostitutes either. What is the culture of this?
Right. So even before that happens, you know, prostitution, you know, which is in the tourism industry, of course, you're going to see the prostitutes. Certain nicks and nookies of the island, you'd see them. Right. But never before, you know, do we know who these women are. You don't really see who they are and why they're doing what they do. You know, and so that's why it was really important for me to humanize them in this book as well. You know, they're just girls wanting to survive. You know, girls who were not given certain opportunities, who feel like this is their only way out. You know, and so that's what I wanted to touch on, especially with Margot's character. But even with Margot's character, I also wanted to touch on, you know, that whole concept of the sexualization of Jamaican girls. Because yes, it happens everywhere. But what happened with our country is that the silence that follows, right? Nobody takes action to arrest these men, right? These perpetrators who invade our bodies. Nobody, you know, even question it. And so, you know, even as late as 2016 or 2015, you know, there are not many organizations in Jamaica that work to help these women. And so I wanted to give those women a voice as well. And I wrote about this in my New York Times essay that was published last week, Sunday. You know, that, you know, we need policies, we need laws that would actually help protect our girls. Because, you know, as early as 12 years old, you know, you're already, you know, under the being looked at as a sexual being, you know, in a country where, you know, if somebody acts on that, if a man acts on that, you know, he's not going to be arrested or anything.
You know, the reason I phrased the question like that, though, was... It is somewhat obvious in the story that you're telling here that the families of these girls see the money coming in, see the clothing that they're buying, knowing that they're disappearing. And there's almost a kind of acquiescence to this is the way it is, and that is the only way that a daughter in this household without an education is going to get the things she wants.
Right. Right. It happens. Huh. And... I mean, I touched on the tourism part of it. You know, I haven't even delved into the city part of the island itself. Because, you know, there are these communities called garrisons, for example, where dons are, you know, they're like the big drug lords who live in these communities. And there are times when girls are sacrificed for their family. You know, these dons see a pretty girl in their neighborhood and, you know, it's her sexuality that helps... pay for her family's rent or help put more food on the table than the rest of the neighbors, right? So you know, it's commodity, like girls' bodies, there's a commodity. It's a commodity. And Margot, you know, she incorporates all that. Like, she knows, you know, she's this woman again, you know, very defeated. And what she uses, she actually uses the weaknesses, or quote unquote weaknesses of the men, of men.
I know.
And also her internal hurts. And that's what she uses. She uses in the book to get ahead.
You know, here's the thing. I felt such sympathy and empathy for Margot until she decided that really the only way to get what she wanted would be to exploit, you know, these young girls, that that she had to be as base and as demeaning as the men that she was serving.
Right.
What kind of a decision was that for you to? I mean, the character could have gone a number of different ways.
Right. That Margot was very challenging to write, in all honesty, but she became my favorite character. You know, when I got deep into Margot's psyche, I really feel like it was more desperation, but she was really acting out of desperation, you know. And what I love about fiction, you know, our characters don't even have to make the most popular choices, right? It's just how are they going to react to something? And really Margot's impulse, you know, her knee-jerk action was, let me do what I know. And so, you know, her past, and she actually had internalized so much growing up, and that's what she knew. So she used that. That was her weapon.
Yeah, I know you. It fits with where the story goes. I guess I wanted, in my rose-colored glasses way, Margot to be more noble, which I guess she doesn't think she has the choice to be.
Right. There was no choice for Margot. And, you know, the thing is that Margot, though, her nobleness to me comes from being that overprotective sister.
Yeah.
Because everything that she's doing, every decision Margot makes is for Tandy to be better, for Tandy to come out not having to do this, not having to manipulate anyone, not having to sleep with anyone to get anywhere. Right. She wants Tandy so much to achieve. And so really for me, the heartbreaking part was when Tandy, who's a teenager, who has her own needs, you know, she doesn't see that, right? For most part, Margot hides a lot from her. And she doesn't see how much what Margot sacrifices for her to achieve. And so in that, you know, I won't give away too much about what happens in the end. But, you know, ultimately, we see that Margot failed.
Yes.
You know, she failed miserably.
Right. Nicole, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Taste of the Caribbean on a Cold Day. You can find all of the books that we loved last year in 2016 and a whole bunch of others on the thread, nprnews.org/thread.